Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Highly interesting article in the New York Times that week in review, is that what it's called? No, I got to learn that at some point. That week in review that I read every week, and it's always got interesting articles. It's the Sunday Review. It's changed its name probably years ago. And it was in the paper on January 22nd. A drug to cure fear. The author who is with us this hour asks, who among us hasn't wanted to let go of anxiety or forget about fears? Phobias, panic attacks, and disorders like post-traumatic stress are extremely common. 29% of American adults will suffer from anxiety at some point in their lives. And so he looks at exposure therapy, but also looks at some drugs that have been used with exposure therapy that have been pretty darn effective. Memories, he says, are uniquely vulnerable to alteration at two points. When we first lay them down and then when we retrieve them. And so we're going to talk about the drugs that are being used here and the fears that many of us have. And some of them are quite, when you look at PTSD, extremely, extremely serious. So it would be so nice to be able to not forget that you've had that experience in your life, but that you can deal with it. Because it is incapacitating for so many people. Joining us this hour is Dr. Richard Friedman. He is a professor of clinical psychiatry and the director of psychopharmacology clinic at Cornell Medical College. He specializes in anxiety and mood disorders, and he is a contributing opinion writer for the New York Times. I would expect we'll have a lot of phone calls on this because we all have our own things, right? We all have our own fears. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. And we are also on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. Dr. Richard Friedman, thank you very much for being with us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's a very interesting article. There are a huge number of us. Actually, the number is high, but I thought it would have been even higher than that of American adults who suffer from anxiety at some point in their lives.
Yes. I mean, it's astoundingly high. It's about 29, 30-something percent. Of course, you know, the emotion of anxiety is universal and everybody has it. That's normal. But when you talk about anxiety disorders, you're talking about anxiety that really gets in the way of a person's being able to function mm-hmm. and enjoy their life. And mm-hmm. there, it's pretty high.
Mm-hmm. And we all have them. When I ask everybody in the office, what are you afraid of? You know, I'm afraid of heights. I'm afraid of dying alone. For me, it's mice. Oh, my gosh, I hate mice. I've moved out of houses for a night right. to a hotel because I won't go in the basement. I mean, it's ridiculous. But for others, some of these are associated with violence or with harm to a person, so that it's very serious. It's more serious than a fear of mice.
Right. But much of anxiety that people have is, as you point out, irrational. After all, you know, compared to a mouse, you're far more powerful, or a spider. And, you know, the key to understanding it is that every anxiety that people have about, you know, particular situation or particular object involves a memory, you know, and an association that they've got between a situation or an object, a snake, a spider, an elevator, and whatever, and something they think that's bad that might happen to them, mm-hmm. like the elevator cable might break and they could die, or they could fall off the building, or they could be bitten by a poisonous snake or spider and die, or, you know, in your case, who knows what that mouse might do if it runs around your house.
Ooh, runs on my feet. Ooh, ooh. Right. I'm sorry. I'm glad you're with us. My psychiatrist is a guest this hour because I'm thinking about it. And when you, that emotional memory is interesting because we remember that. You may forget, as you remind us in the article, where you put your wallet, and that's no big deal. But those instances where maybe something bad did happen, man, they're in your mind forever, it seems.
Right, because memory that's formed under the influence of emotion, for reasons we can talk about, those memories are burned in, and some of them are indelible. And the reason is that when you get excited and you get emotional, or you're anxious, and something bad happens to you, biologically, your body starts producing adrenaline. And in the brain, the related chemical is norepinephrine, very close relative to adrenaline. And that that neurotransmitter, that substance in the brain, actually makes you learn more intensely. And it's the reason why, let's say, you know, the most effective teachers in school, the ones who incite a little bit of anxiety and even a little bit of fear. And as anxiety goes up, learning goes up, especially emotional learning, until you reach a critical point where you start going down the other side and, you know, people who are terrified don't learn very well. But the idea is, you know, memory that's formed under the influence of powerful emotion tends to be very, very enduring.
Mm-hmm. So you tell us that for a long time now, what we've been using, the current standard, is exposure therapy. If you're afraid of spiders, you are around spiders a lot?
Right. So the idea is, you know, up to now, the basic way of treating fears, you know, specific fears, which we also call phobias, is to take the thing that you're afraid of or the situation you're afraid of and expose the person to it, the very thing they don't want to do. So let's say you're afraid of spiders or you're afraid of blood. So I would take you into the lab. First, I'd show you a picture of a spider, or I might show you slides or pictures of people having their blood taken. And then little by little, I'd bring you closer and closer to the situation that makes you nervous or anxious. And then what I'm essentially doing is teaching you that the thing that you were afraid of that's going to cause a terrible thing to happen is not true. So I'm going to cause you to learn a new memory. So when it comes to, let's say, spiders, I show you a picture, I bring you into a lab, I show you a spider, you get to see nothing terrible is going to happen. I bring you in, you get your blood drawn, you don't faint, nothing terrible is going to happen, you're not going to die. You learn that this association you've got in your mind, that this was a dangerous object or a dangerous situation, is no longer true. So I give you a new memory.
Right.
But what I don't do is to erase the old one. So still in your mind and in your brain, the old association is still encoded. It's still there. And it lives in your brain side by side with the new memory, which I've given you in treatment. So as long as the new memory is, you know, in control and has the upper hand, you're fine. But if you get exposed with sufficient intensity to the, you know, thing that you're afraid of, let's say, you know, I've gotten you used to going and having your blood drawn and nothing terrible happens. But, you know, a week later you're out on the street and you see someone get hit by a car and there's just blood splattering all over the place.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, that fear you have of blood is going to come rushing back
because
that memory is still in your brain and it's very easy to unlock it.
And is that even more so for people who have been exposed to really horrendous things, like being in war and seeing somebody killed who's a friend of yours right in front of you, or being exposed to violence, be the victim of violence if you're raped or something?
Right.
Does that make it even more difficult?
Right. So we think it does. And the reason is that, you know, the more powerful the emotional state, the bigger the trauma, and there are other things that make traumas more disturbing and more enduring. The deeper that memory, the stronger that memory, and the harder it is to, you know, eradicate it by exposure. And then, you know, the problem with exposure therapy is, one, people often don't like it. It's hard. It's upsetting to be exposed to the thing that scares you. It's not for everybody. Not everyone can tolerate it. And even those people who tolerate it, let's say who have PTSD, only about half of people who get exposure therapy actually lose their trauma, lose their PTSD.
So, enter the picture, a beta blocker.
Right. So this is a different kind of treatment for dealing with fear memory. And it's a complicated thing. It sounds almost science fiction-like. But basically, it involves doing two things. It involves retrieving the memory, the thing that upsets you. Let's take, for example, the study that I mentioned in the piece about people who have spider phobias, arachnophobes. So what this researcher did is she took people into the lab who had a spider phobia, and she showed them a tarantula, rather a large spider. Some of them are about the size of the mice that you don't like.
Ooh.
And she brings them into the lab. She shows them the spider, but only for 2 minutes. Then, right after she shows them the spider, she gives them this drug called propranolol, which is a beta blocker. And this is a drug that's been used for years. It's an old drug. It's a drug that's used for performance anxiety.
Oh.
Why? Because this drug blocks the effects of adrenaline. It blocks the receptors in your brain and in the periphery for adrenaline. And what happens when you do that is it blocks a lot of the physical sensation of anxiety. You know, when you're nervous in front of a group of people, you get a rapid heart rate, you get dry mouth, you get butterflies in your stomach, you get tremulous, your palms sweat. It stops that cold
right. Because
it blocks the effects of adrenaline. And because adrenaline enhances learning and memory, it disrupts memory. So when you give somebody, when you expose them to the fear memory, let's say in this case it's the spider, the moment you retrieve the memory, something really interesting happens. The memory becomes fragile and easily influenced. So memories are not exactly written in stone. And in fact, they can be influenced when you first learn something and then when you are asked to retrieve the memory. So when she shows people the spider in the lab and then gives them propranolol, by retrieving the memory, she makes the memory susceptible to the influence of propranolol.
That's fascinating.
Yeah. And so what happens is, normally, if I ask you to retrieve the memory and I don't give you anything to disrupt the memory, it makes the memory, it refreshes the memory and makes it stronger.
Mm-hmm.
But if I give you propranolol right after retrieving the memory, I'm now disrupting a process called reconsolidation, which is when you retrieve a memory and then put it back in storage. And it's the putting it back in storage which this drug is disrupting. And the curious thing is, when you disrupt it with propranolol, the memory becomes weaker, and sometimes the emotional memory is completely erased. So these people who are exposed to the spider for just 2 minutes, then given this beta blocker, 4 days later, they have the spider, you know, they're touching the spider.
Ooh, my.
And, you know, they can put the spider 3 months later in their hands, and a year later even, their fear is gone. Now, they don't forget the fact that they once were afraid of spiders. So this is not like erasing memory, meaning the fact that they once were afraid of spiders remains with them. So if you interview these people, they say, oh, yeah, I know I used to have a spider phobia, but now, for some strange reason, I just don't feel afraid of them. So biographical memory is unaffected. It's just emotional memory that's affected by this procedure.
Mm-hmm. And we don't want our biographical memory to go away. As you recall, as you say in the article, we don't want to forget about... it's horrible that it ever happened, but we don't want to forget about concentration camps.
Right. We don't want to forget about all the bad things humanity has done
right. And
the things that we still can do. And there are all kinds of reasons why you don't want to do that. And also, I mean, you don't want to forget about many things that are important to be afraid of. Like, people are concerned about, let's say, terrorism. They're concerned about the economy. They're concerned about political candidates. You know, those are, you know, pieces of information and facts that you do not want to tamper with.
Mm-hmm. Have you tried this yourself? Do you have any fears or not?
I do. I'm afraid of spiders.
Oh, you are?
Yeah. I mean, not quite as bad as some of the subjects in her study, and I was talking to this researcher about it, and it was very funny, actually. She said, next time you're in Amsterdam, come by and we'll play with a tarantula and I'll cure you.
And, oh, you know, sure, I'll be right over.
Right. So, you know, we have a house up in the country, and there are lots of big spiders there, and every summer, in the very beginning of the summer, I get exposed to these spiders. I know the whole drill with exposure, and by the end of the summer, I don't like them, but they don't bother me.
Mm-hmm.
Then the year goes by. I'm in the city. I live in New York City. I don't see them. And sure enough, at the beginning of the next summer, boom, all of a sudden, I see these big spiders, and they bother me, and I have to get re-exposed, which is exposure therapy all over again every time, because, you know, that old memory is still there. So I said, you know, next time I'm in Amsterdam, I'm going to stop by.
Well, I think that would be a really good idea. You'll be a new man.
Yeah. I'll get a pet tarantula.
Oh, you don't have to go that far. A dog is always better. Much better. Let's welcome phone calls. I think we'll have many of them. This is more. I knew this was going to be interesting, but he's a great guest. Dr. Richard Friedman is our guest, A Drug to Cure Fear. It was in the New York Times Sunday Review on January 22nd. Who among us hasn't wanted to let go of anxiety or forget about fear? Phobias, panic attacks, and disorders like post-traumatic stress are extremely common. Upwards of 29% of American adults will suffer from anxiety at some point in their lives. So here is something that, you know, exposure therapy is what we've been doing. Here's something we can add to it to make you not forget that you used to be fearful, but allow you to get to a point where you can say, I'm no longer fearful of spiders or heights or whatever your fear may be. It's fascinating. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go to phone calls for Dr. Richard Friedman, and we start with Margie in Milwaukee. Hi, Margie.
Hi.
Hi.
You have the best programs, I'll tell you. This is fascinating. I have three really quick questions. First of all, is it dose-related, and is it does it one dose do this? And right. Also, if somebody's been taking it for years for other reasons, how is this affecting their memory and their memory processing and their anxiety levels on a regular basis?
Wonderful questions. So each one of them. So it appears that this requires just one dose of the medicine to cause disruption of memory, and that you don't need to take it beyond that one dose. No one knows exactly what the dose relationship is between the size of the effect and the dose, because only one dose was used, which was 40 milligrams of propranolol, which is also called Inderol for those listeners who know it by the trade name. And the fascinating question you asked is, if people are taking beta blockers, let's say often people take beta blockers as part of treatment for hypertension, you know, does that affect memory? It doesn't appear to affect the ability to learn new memory. But one interesting question is whether people who are taking beta blockers, because they're on beta blockers that partially block the effects of adrenaline, whether they are at lower risk of developing, you know, some anxiety problems like PTSD when they are exposed to trauma during their life. And no one knows the answer to that. You know, some people have even speculated that we could try to prevent people from getting trauma by giving them beta blockers, you know, like soldiers, for example, or journalists who have to go and report in war zones, you know, ahead of time to block the effects, the memory, you know, enhancing effects of adrenaline in people exposed to trauma. But no one actually knows whether that works.
Nobody's done a study of that, doctor.
People have shown that if you use propranolol, you can actually obliterate the memory-enhancing effects of emotion. That's perfectly clear. So if, for example, one very interesting study that was done by Larry Cahill in California years ago, he read a story to a group of subjects, and the story basically was a kid gets up, his mother takes him in the car, from school, and they're going to visit his father in the emergency room and have lunch. That's story one. Story two is the same thing, except along the way they see a car accident. Mm. And something terrible happens, and this kid sees something very, very violent.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when you read those stories to people and you ask them to remember them, people have a selectively better memory for the emotionally wrought story, because emotion, it arouses emotion when people hear the story, and they retain the story better. So that just is an illustration that emotionally charged, you know, material is encoded in a different way, is learned better.
Mm.
Now, if you give people a beta blocker ahead of time and then read the same story, you wipe out the difference between the emotional story and the neutral story. So the beta blocker gets in the way of the memory enhancement by emotion. So we know that that is certainly the case. And whether you can prevent trauma from happening is a different story.
Mm. So fit in this for me, because I've never understood this. I hate watching violent films. I hate seeing any kind of violence. I won't watch them. I close my eyes. Why is it that most of us will stop to see that accident and become emotionally charged ourselves and horrified by what we've seen, or that we'll watch war films or we'll participate in war? Is there something that happens that we kind of like about being emotionally charged by that kind of horror?
Well, presumably, because if you look at our culture and you look at
media
and you look at what's popular, you know, just one quick look at digital media and what's in the movies is violence, violence, violence. It's quite exciting. And it's, you know, when you see a violent movie or you watch a violent video, you do it from the safe place of your home. So it's a vicarious experience of violence. You're not actually in danger, but you get to experience the, you know, adrenaline rush. And, you know, for some people it's overly stimulating and it's unpleasant. Others love it. It's like a roller coaster.
Right, right. Let's go to, thanks, Margie, so much for your call. Brenda in Madison. Hi, Brenda.
Hi there.
Hi.
Hi.
So I'm calling mainly, I'm an Iraq veteran, and I have PTSD, and I've just started some exposure therapy with EMDR, and I just had my first session this week.
Right.
And I'm liking to hear about propranolol. So my first question is that if we recommend this, you know, for like dosing and stuff, what's the original article author's name to get that information?
Uh-huh. So the author in the study that I cited on spiders is Meryl Kint, spelled K-I-N-D-T, and she is a psychologist and researcher in Amsterdam, Holland. And, you know, if you go to the New York Times article, there'll be a link there where if you wanted to write to her and communicate to her, you can send an email to her. No one has actually done a study using this procedure in people who have, like you do, PTSD or other sorts of anxiety problems, so it's not clear that it would work, but it might, and it might have some benefit. So it's definitely worth talking to your doctor, and it's also worth investigating. She's doing some studies now in people who have other anxiety problems like panic disorder, but I'm not sure that anyone has done it yet in post-traumatic stress disorder.
Hmm. Do you mind, Brenda, giving us just a brief outline of what kind of treatment you're receiving for PTSD? What's the therapy like?
Well, when I first came home, I went to counseling, and that was cognitive behavioral therapy. And now I'm 10 years from being at home, and the EMDR is like exposure therapy where you try to take yourself back to these negative situations. But like what I experienced this week, I was pretty much flat emotionally, like my body wouldn't let me emotionally get there. The premise of this exposure therapy is that you know, when these events happened, I sort of like left my body, so to say, and didn't really feel what was happening. And then you may experience healing from this trauma if you actually go back and feel and, you know, sort of feel this experience, so to say.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Friedman.
Do you feel that that's working, that it's helping you?
Well, I feel like a lot of stuff came up, but, you know, I just did it once so far, so
Maybe it's too soon to know.
Yeah, for sure. But I know for sure, like, going back there was scary.
I'm sure it was. That's one of the problems with exposure therapy, I'd imagine, Dr. Friedman, is going back there is scary.
Right. I'm wondering whether, Brenda, when you had the exposure, it was so unpleasant that you didn't want to continue with it.
Well, it's like, you know, she was encouraging me to, like, get there and sort of feel this emotionally, but I was more, like, narrating where I was than actually feeling that I was, like, back there.
Mm-hmm.
Which, that's the whole part of this, is that you have this trauma and you tuck it deep down inside and you sort of numb yourself to it.
Right. Well, it'll be interesting to see if it's going to work, and I'm surprised that there hasn't been some studying of people with PTSD, Dr. Friedman, because so many people have PTSD.
Right. It's you know, the number of returning vets like Brenda who have PTSD after being in war, and sometimes not even being in war, but being active duty soldiers and anticipating being in war, is so high after after the Iraq and Afghanistan wars, that it's a major, major public health problem. And, you know, researchers are working very hard to, you know, design new treatments, more effective treatments. You know, exposure helps, antidepressants help, but, you know, as Brenda's saying, it's not so easy to deal with the problem. One, because it's so unpleasant, the experience of having to remember all of these things in exposure therapy, all these experiences that are very painful.
Mm-hmm. I hope you get better, Brenda, and thank you very much for calling. It would certainly be helpful to be in touch with that researcher, and maybe something new will develop in treatment. Jen writes this on Facebook to us, Doctor, much better to learn appropriate coping skills to deal with our fear and get stronger. We underestimate the human capacity for resilience.
Good point. You know, they're not mutually exclusive in my mind. You know, the distinction between, you know, the brain and the mind is artificial. So, you know, even when you talk about coping skills and things that you do to enhance your resilience, when you do those things, it brings about certain biological changes in the brain. But I'm a pragmatist. Whatever makes people better and whatever way they find of making themselves better is great. Now, that could be by confronting the fear and seeing, you know, learning that it's really nothing to be afraid of in exposure therapy. But some people find that hard to take. And actually, some people prefer not to talk so much and would rather have relief in the form of a pill. And I don't see that there's anything wrong with that. Mm-hmm. I would just say any and all treatments that have safety and efficacy should be on the table.
Ashley is next. Hi, Ashley.
Hi.
Hi.
I was curious as to what your guest thought about its possible benefit for sexual abuse victims. My mother is a victim, and it happened, gosh, almost a decade ago now. So, to my knowledge, it only really bothers her once a year, right around the time when it happened.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm just curious if maybe there's any studies that that have been done in that aspect where she's past that initial, that initial traumatic phase. I've never had any traumatic experience. I'm terrible at trying to explain this, but and then I can take my
right.
my comment off the air.
All right, Ashley.
Right. So that's a very interesting question. I mean, if somebody's been sexually traumatized, and the exposure to trauma, you know, has had an impact, let's say, on their ability to be intimate with other people in their lives, then they want to do something about it. They want to have treatment. But if in the case, let's say, of your mother, who, let's say, truly is only bothered by it as a kind of anniversary response to, you know, when it happened every year, and it just happens once a year, you know, you have to ask yourself the question whether you want to actually engage somebody like that in a therapy for an event which is so rare. If it really just happens once a year, do you need to do something in the way of an intervention or just be upset by something once a year? I wonder about that.
Mm. Yeah. I don't know if we've talked about this or not, but if so, it's okay. Please excuse me, but I'm wondering about this time frame. You write in the article that there's a very narrow time window after retrieving a fear memory when you can disrupt that memory. Why is it that it's so small, and how small is it?
Right. I'm so glad you asked that. Right. So it appears that, you know, when you learn things or when you retrieve memories and then put them back in storage, there's a biological event that happens in the brain. And that biological event involves the formation of connections between nerve cells, and it involves the synthesis of protein. Literally, structurally, things are happening and changing in your brain when you learn and when you recall things. And so when you retrieve a memory, like Dr. Kint did in her study with the spider, the memory becomes subject to biological change. And it's just in that state for a little while, for a couple of hours, until it's put back in storage. Protein synthesis happens, the biological effect occurs, and then it's over. It's kind of like, I'm trying to think of an analogy. Okay, if you were to take, you know, if you think about a candle, when you heat up wax, you can mold it.
Mm-hmm.
But you have a very narrow window in which you can mold it before it gets cold and forms into a new shape and is hardened.
Mm-hmm.
So you can think of the memory formation a little like that. It's a kind of a primitive analogy, but, you know, the fact is, once you subject the memory to retrieval and it becomes easily influenced, you have a short period of time in which to influence it biologically. Mm. And in animal studies, it's hours. We don't know yet in humans how long it is, but it's probably not that much longer.
Aren't we something? I'm thinking about all the memories that we have. It's just amazing, isn't it?
Yes. Remarkable.
Yeah. Well, Ashley, thanks for your call. Joe in Madison. Hi.
Hi.
Hi,
thanks
Joe.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So, just want to give you a very brief history. I've had a general anxiety disorder from a very early age. And I'm in my late 40s right now, but like I said, very early age I had it. Never knew what it was, and was never diagnosed for it. Never seeked out any help for it until I was in my mid-20s. I finally decided to find out what was going on with me and go out and get some help. And so I've been on propranolol, Inderol for 20 plus years now. And over the years, it's kind of turned into to help my anxiety disorder along with hypertension, high blood pressure. And has it helped? Yeah. But it also, I mean, it's not 100%, it's not perfect. And I think like you were talking about before, there has to be the combination of, you know, you have to have positive self thoughts and if going out and talking to people or talking to a doctor or a specialist, and along with the combination of the medicine, I think for me that's what works best, just a combination of everything. Mm-hmm. And also, I guess, one quick question for you is, you know, over time, like I said, I've been on this for 20-plus years. Does it ever get to the point where your body becomes kind of immune to it and it doesn't work as well as it maybe used to?
Right. That's a very interesting question. So, you know, in terms of its effect on anxiety and being able to block, you know, adrenaline and decrease some of the physical symptoms of anxiety, you know, receptors, you know, the body's not a machine. So the receptors over time can change in number and they can change in response when they're being blocked by a drug like propranolol. And, you know, they can shift around, and it may actually be the case that, and also the fact that, you know, your metabolism changes over time. It can speed up, it can go down. You may have interaction of propranolol with other drugs so that the amount of propranolol your body is seeing could vary from time to time, so that the dose over time may need to be adjusted. But, you know, the point that you made about, you know, the benefits of being able to not just take the medicine to block the physical effects of anxiety, but have someone to talk to about the things you worry about is critical, because people who are generally anxious tend to worry about things and see the glass as half empty instead of half full. And when they can challenge their own thinking that makes them anxious, they actually feel less anxious. So that's a very important thing.
Mm. Thank you so much, Joe, for your call. Lute in River Falls. Hi.
Hello.
Hi, Lute.
Hello. I had a phobia from the time I was about 5 and had tremendous help, which was just a spontaneous thing, and really overcame that when I was around 18. And the phobia was snakes.
Snakes?
Snakes. Mm-hmm. And on a trip, what did my family do? But they took us to reptile gardens. I believe it was in South Dakota. And there were snakes in the trees. There were. I couldn't breathe. I mean, I didn't feel like I could breathe. And there was a man standing there who had a snake around his shoulders, and he was holding a head in one hand and a tail in the other. And he looked at me, and he knew. And he said, "You're scared to death, aren't you?" Mm. And all I could do was nod.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, "I can help you if you'll let me. Do you want to be scared like this?" On and on. And I said, "No, absolutely. I shook my head, no." And so little by little by little, he was extremely patient and extremely understanding. The first thing he had me do, he said, "Now, the snake is as warm as I am, so touch my arm. That's as warm as the snake." And on he went, and also telling me what the snake was afraid of, that it could only stay exposed to people for about an hour. And if he kept them out longer than that, they died of a heart attack.
Uh-huh.
And he, by the time I was finished talking with him, I had the snake on my shoulders, and I had a head in one hand and a tail in the other. Now, I have never been able to do that since, but I can see a snake and in the grass and look, bend down and look at it, and my heart isn't thumping, and I'm not waking up in the night afraid of snakes.
Mm-hmm.
So the man did me a tremendous favor.
Dr. Friedman.
That is a wonderful story.
Yes, it is.
Fabulous story, especially because it underscores the fact that, you know, people naturally understand the principle of exposure, and this guy, who was very clever, you know, saw that you were terrified, you know, and by the way, you were in a situation where you were close to what we call flooding, where, you know, you're not just given one little snake or a picture of a snake. You're surrounded by snakes and trees. Snakes are everywhere. So you were, you know, there were snakes all over the place. And what he did was he connected with you. He saw you were afraid, and he made you think about the snake in a different way than you usually do, which is, it's not a scary thing. It's not a dangerous thing. He even told you the snake itself was vulnerable and could die.
Mm-hmm.
So he made the snake less dangerous to you by talking to you about the snake, and then little by little he desensitized you. So you learned, and it seems like it was an enduring and powerful memory that this guy gave you quite a gift. He taught you, literally taught you, that what you were afraid of was really not so dangerous and so bad after all, and it stayed with you, which is fantastic.
It sure is. Great story, and thank you, Lute, so much for calling. We have lines open. They've been pretty crowded, but you'll be able to call and get somebody to say that it's somebody would be Scotty. Hello, can I help you? So we're going to take more phone calls. Dr. Richard Friedman is our guest. Wrote a fascinating piece in this past Sunday Review in the New York Times, A Drug to Cure Fear, and that it's exactly what the article is about. He is a professor of clinical psychiatry and the director of the psychopharmacology, to get it correct, clinic at the Cornell Medical College. He specializes in anxiety and mood disorders. And here's how you reach our conversation, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And the email is talk@wpr.org, Facebook, where if you like us, we'll send you little messages that let you know what we're talking about every day, which might be helpful for your life. That's the Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter is @KDunnShow. This, what you're listening to, is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Dr. Richard Friedman is with us this hour. Our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. There's a thing about, and I'm trying to put in the association of the whole conversation we're having, there's a thing about memory and anxiety and not REM sleep, but is it deep sleep that you write about, Doctor?
Right. So what I was writing about there was something a little bit different, and that is the phenomenon of panic attacks that people have, and these are episodic, you know, storms of anxiety. And I was talking about the fact that some people have them in the middle of the night when they're asleep, and that one of the reasons they seem to happen at night, these so-called nocturnal panic attacks, is that when people sleep and go into deep sleep, and it's not dream sleep where this happens, but another form of sleep called non-REM deep sleep, the levels of carbon dioxide in the blood go up because your breathing rate goes down. So carbon dioxide rises, and, you know, when carbon dioxide rises in your brain, it's a sign that, you know, the oxygen content of the environment around you is going down. So it's kind of like an alarm signal. You better start breathing because you're going to suffocate. Normally, people do not wake up in the middle of the night as their carbon dioxide goes up, and they don't panic. But people with panic disorder do, and they have what we call a false suffocation alarm. They're overly sensitive to carbon dioxide, and they react as if they're going to suffocate.
Let's go to John next in Chippewa Falls. Hi, John.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm 68 years old, and I've had generalized anxiety, which started out with, it's always been kind of been travel anxiety, and however I can classify, I think, under generalized. Travel anxiety, afraid that I'm going to get sick when I travel. So I do not travel if I can help it, and I travel not with friends. My wife is okay as long as I don't go very far. Aerobic exercise helps, however, and I think I do get Valium, but I don't use it very often. I end up being too zonked out if I travel. If I try to travel and do any Valium or any aerobic exercise, then I really can't function very well. Mm-hmm. So the aerobic exercise seems to knock out the anxiety.
Right.
But, yeah, my mother has had this. I have a first cousin that has it severely, and I have a couple of siblings that also have it. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Same form that they're afraid that they will get sick when they travel, or it takes different forms?
It takes the different forms. They don't go anyplace. Mm-hmm. Like it used to be. And a metaphobia thing for me, and now it's not that anymore. It's never been that for them. They just don't want to travel. One's housebound.
Mm. Right, right. Mm-hmm. No, so what you're describing is a very common anxiety phobia that people have, and that's the fear about being away from home and finding yourself in a situation where, you know, either you're going to get sick or something bad will happen and you'll feel unsafe.
Mm-hmm.
Something bad's going to happen and you won't be able to be safe and get home again. And here's the thing. If you use a drug like Valium or any member of the same family, which we call benzodiazepines or Valium and Ativan and Klonopin, you know, it can make you feel less anxious, of course. But in order to get over the anxiety that you have, a very effective way of doing it is a gradual progression of travel in a very slight way, going away from the house, let's say, a mile at a time, little by little, without Valium. Because if you take away the anxiety with Valium, or if you exercise to make yourself less anxious, you can't get desensitized. There's no shortcut. In order to get desensitized and learn that the thing you're afraid of is really not dangerous, you have to allow yourself to experience anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
As long as you block the anxiety with Valium, you know, of course you'll be able to travel, but you won't get desensitized. It will make it much harder.
I've been in three therapy sessions, and I've given up with them. And the first session that I was in, eventually the therapist says, "Oh, I didn't know you had it so bad."
Uh-huh. Well,
I know I didn't belong with them.
Right.
I talked the last time I talked to the guy about desensitization, and I said, you know. He says, well, then, yeah, you go a little bit, and then you come back, and you say, well, look, and I made this. And I said, no. I come back, and I say, wow, I got through that. I'm not going to do that again.
Hmm. Right. Well, that may mean that you went too far. Hmm. The steps have to be small, and you have to be really patient, and you probably have to have somebody with you to do it.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for the call. Tell us about the experience you had. You were in Costa Rica, I believe, and somebody was doing one of those, I don't know why anybody does those things, anyhow, those zip line things. And luckily, you, the psychiatrist, were with him because all of a sudden this guy starts hyperventilating.
Right. So I happen to like heights. And so a zip line is, you know, as many of your listeners know, you know, it's a wire that's strung up between two high places. Then you are in a little seat and you're zooming along in the tree level, in the rainforest in this case. And so what happened was there was a young guy there who started hyperventilating on the platform next to me. And it was clear he was having a panic attack. So I asked him what was going on. He said, oh, I've had a fear of heights my whole life. And I thought, well, what are you doing here?
Right.
What he was doing there was he had exposed himself over the last couple of years to treat himself, and he had actually succeeded. But here he found himself in the jungle on the highest platform, and all of a sudden his exposure therapy had hit its limit, and he started to panic. So I said, you know, there's two options. One is, you know, you can strap yourself to me, and we can go across on the zip line together, or we just walk down the ladder to the base, which was, you know, about 75 steps. Which is what he opted for. So I talked him down, and we went down the ladder together.
Oh, do you think he was close to go? That was awfully nice of you to say we can zip line together.
Well, it seemed faster, but I couldn't convince him.
No. All right, let's go to Jane in Ashland. Hi.
Hi. Two things. The brain is the physical organ of the physical body, and I heard someone say some time ago that it takes the brain about 15 seconds to lay down the basic foundation for long-term memory. And the second thing I want to talk about was nutrition. It's been thought since 1960s. The nutritionists believe that there was much to be done with the nutrition as far as anxieties and various mental problems.
Do you think nutrition has a component here, Dr. Friedman?
Well, nutrition has a component in every aspect of health, whether you're talking about brain health or other non-psychiatric medical conditions. The problem, though, with nutrition is, you know, it's very hard to do experiments, controlled experiments with nutrition, because people don't eat supplements, they eat foods. So most of the information, most of the best information about nutrition we have come from these enormous epidemiologic observational studies, and they tend to look at, you know, medical problems like heart disease and high blood pressure and things like that, but not at the behavioral effects of nutrition, although I think it's very important.
Thanks, Jane, very much for your call. This, all that we've been talking about, is this readily available? Are there people who are using the combination of the drug and exposure therapy in clinics all over the United States, or is this mostly a European thing, or what?
So, very interesting. It's been done in animal studies, this whole exploration of being able to examine the formation of memories and block the reconsolidation of memories with propranolol and also other drugs. In humans, it's not been studied very much clinically. It is very new. And what Dr. Kint did, she's among the first. There are other people here in the United States. There's a colleague of mine, Dr. Elizabeth Phelps, who's done pioneering work in this area, who's at NYU, and Dr. Joseph Ledoux, who's done some of the basic science and actually elucidating the areas and the circuits in the brain that are very important in encoding emotional fear and learning. And so, you know, many of your listeners can go read more about that if they're interested, but there's very little that's done in this area clinically.
I see. But that's about to change, Dr. Friedman?
I think it will change.
And you will be among the first, so you don't ever have to worry about spiders again.
Right.
Right? Yeah.
Right.
Kim and Ladysmith, getting short on time, but we still have a wee bit left. Hi, Kim.
Okay. Hi.
Hi.
Thank you. Well, I have a little PTSD, I think, going on, and it started when I was around 5, and my little puppy got run over by my mother, and then probably about 10 years ago, I lost a chihuahua to a Rottweiler, and he was behind a fence, and my chihuahua went through the, you know, a little part of the fence.
Yeah.
And I couldn't really do anything about it. And I even see, like, you know, dead animals along the road. And I'm like, no, don't look. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And it's just kind of a weird thing. It doesn't affect my life all that much, but I'm really protective of my other dogs around other dogs, you know, and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Friedman.
Right. Well, you know, you have had really traumatic experiences losing, you know, let's say a pet, which has got a special form of relationship with people, and, you know, and that's an enduring memory. A colleague of mine once said, when I told him, because I love dogs, and I was very sad when my last dog died, and I said, you know, what do people do when they're grief-stricken after a loss like that? There's really no treatment for this. A very wise guy. And he said, oh, yes, there is a treatment for grief. And I said, what is that? And he said, the treatment for grief is love, meaning, you know, you have another attachment, you have another pet, and hopefully you form, you know, new positive memories, and you can sort of bear the pain and the sadness of the loss. But in the bigger picture, you've got something there in your life to replace it that's really warm and positive.
Mm. Well, in addition to many other messages, the answer to grief is love. We'll take that with us. Thank you so much, Dr. Friedman. This was fascinating. You're a great guest.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to be with you.
Good. Join us again, please. Dr. Richard Friedman, our guest this hour. His piece is in the Sunday Review section of the New York Times, January 22nd, A Drug to Cure Fear. 29% of American adults suffer from anxiety, and some of it is quite severe, the result of trauma in life. And so this is not yet widely used kind of therapy, but a combination of exposure therapy and this drug that's being used at the appropriate time might do a whole lot for a whole lot of us. Dr. Friedman, professor of clinical psychiatry, and he is at Cornell Medical College. Thanks to Scotty Myers for producing this interesting show, and to Scotty Myers and Kendra Smith, who's our new intern who started recently for on-air production here in downtown Milwaukee. Thanks for listening.